Blog Talk Radio.
Morning, everybody. This is Kevin Boileau. Now's Rita Goldhammer's on the show today. We're here at Epis Radio, coming to you from North America. We're soon to be entering our seventh year of broadcasting, which is a long time indeed. And I just wanted to say how grateful that I am to be able to be here to continue to talk. We do publish our transcripts as books on Amazon.com. They're only a few bucks. You can make a great contribution if you believe in what we're doing simply by buying a couple of our books. We really appreciate it. That's what keeps things going. And keep in mind, the reason for that is that we're not funded by money-hungry, acquisition-oriented corporations. That is not how we operate. We will never operate that way. We'll never be controlled by money. At the same time, we need money. And so there's no paradox in that. It's just that we have a different point of view about it. So today we're going to finish up at least a section of the relationship between violence, nihilism, and capitalism. And then next time we're going to start the discussion about praxis. You can't really solve a problem without discussing praxis. You got to have praxis. So we've established that we live in a very violent culture. We've established that capitalism has colonized pretty much every aspect of our lives, even love. It's if you can find any kind of loving relationship, whether it be friendship, romance, sexuality, that's free from capitalism, by all means, go for it, because it won't be that long until the bureaucracy of capitalism fully colonizes the human anthropology. And when that happens, we're done, and we're very close. So we, as we've been saying, exist in a condition of nihilism. And so I write in our new book on violence, what is difficult for a dialectical analysis of violence is that if it exists as part of nihilism, it does not exist as a separable, distinct entity. They both assert the inessentiality of things, but at different levels. Now, this is really interesting because, remember, what nihilism does is it instrumentalizes all values, everything. It instrumentalizes every single thing, friendship, love, working relationships, organizations. And it just occurred to me that to fully instrumentalize your reality means that there's nothing that's an intrinsic value. That's what nihilism does. So you may argue that there are intrinsic values, but you have to discuss how they have force and effect. When we may have a value that doesn't really do any good. So they by asserting this though, we by asserting that there's an inessentiality to things, then and by instrumentalizing everything, we do something with temporality. And in a lot of analyses about the human anthropology, all roads lead to time, temporality, how we interpret our time. And what does that mean? So if I assert the inessentiality of something in my present, it means I'm regarding it in a certain way. I'm doing something with time that I think is distortive. So if I think that something in my present is inessential, or a relationship or a job, and it's just a way to get to something else, then it doesn't have a value of its own. And that means that the very way I regard its value has something to do with a trick that I'm playing on my mind in temporalizing my life, projecting forward into the future, which is in the phenomenological vernacular a protension. There's a retention, an intention, and a protension. So if nothing is essential, that means I'm never really firmly anchored in the moment. It means that I'm not attaching to anything intrinsic, no matter what it is. And, you know, intuitively, it feels like there's something wrong. But psychologically, think about what that does if you're denying the essentiality of the moment, or that you would attach to the moment and then detach from the moment. So there are various schools in the United States that purport to teach Eastern religion and Eastern philosophy, and you have a watered-down type of learning that I've seen, that I've experienced. In not all, but many of these forums, and they'll teach you things like everything passes, or all this is an illusion. And to stop there at that analysis is it totally inauthentic. It is immoral. It is irresponsible. The fact of the matter is, a healthy person attaches and then detaches. You attach to a relationship. You attach to a way of life. You attach to a project. And it's about a healthy attaching and detaching, or transforming your attachment. So this is part of what I've been examining, which is the opposite of a bad faith that we experience in the establishment of things, right? We can become so absorbed into culture and cultural valuation where we lose our autonomy. Now, I can give evidence of that for weeks. People actually lose themselves. They lose the ability to think for themselves. And so on the other side of things, then, there's a kind of a reaction that happens psychologically. At least this is my hypothesis. And that is, people, they like vacations. They like holidays. Whether it's in a martini glass, a marijuana joint, a stronger drug, you know, 2 weeks in Hawaii, whatever, right? But there are these vacations and holidays that we take from the mind. The problem is that we then posit the transcendent as a destination. It becomes part of the distorted non-self doctrine, and there's no responsibility. I've seen this in various communities that will make the implicit argument that as long as they're doing well, not hurting anybody directly, that they're not contributing to a violent culture. But that's bad faith. That's another distortion in thought. So you've got loss of self through the established order. You've got loss of self through these ecstatic practices. And then you have also, I think, another loss of self through violence. And I've only recently become aware of how that works. In violence, we lose ourselves. We lose our responsibility. We lose our critical thinking. If you resort to violence, it means that you gave up. It's a moral issue as well. It's an issue of will. So in nihilism, which supports violence, there's a disordered culture. It's a disordered culture. And in a disordered, chaotic culture, it's hard to think about anything. I've noticed this a lot lately. Many people, if not most people, have a hard time ordering their thinking in a holistic sense, a global sense, a responsible self sense. They might order their thinking for a job or a project or a task, but that's to fall in the non-self of type one, which is the established order. You see, so it requires a lot of constant effort to maintain the responsible self, the aware self, the authentic self. And it is really easy to become complacent. It's really easy to give up. It's really easy to enjoy obfuscation, to say, well, we're never going to figure it out anyway, so whatever. It's very easy to use violence as catharsis, which is part of the non-self doctrine. So there are all these tropes, subjective tropes or topologies. They're algorithms. More serious ones are psychosis. The psychotic person is not too far from the truth, actually. And it requires a lot of willpower to stand back from that. So in a violent nihilism, and I'm going to get Nasrita out of the show in just a moment here. So violence is a type of nihilism. It's a type of destruction. It's a type of deception. It's a type of irresponsible self-structure. It's a catharsis. It doesn't reorder anything. It is childlike. It is regressive. And in a lot of ways, violence is like drinking alcohol, or it's like an addictive noematic focus. You know, where you're losing yourself in the addictive flow. So, you know, how do we posit it as a problem to solve is a question. We're going to take that up. You know, some inroads on that next week. But why did we ever become this way? Why did we ever create a human civilization that is destroying important resources at larger rates every day, and animal species and other species, and resources of the forest, and resources of water, resources of the ground? Why did that ever happen? You know, there are reasons. There are historical reasons that this happened. And it's like, I'm going to digress for a moment in a way, but if you think about it poetically or in a literary way, a narrative way, human beings are, I think, basically desperate. If you think about, and if you accept evolution in some form, it's almost like we're the childlike species who is never going to grow up. And we're afraid. We're the fearful childlike species who's never going to grow up. And we destroy the world. Maybe we destroy the world because we don't like it. And I'm fast coming to this conclusion. It just seems so absurd that we wouldn't like our world, that we hate it, that we hate life. But I'm fast coming to the conclusion that human beings, more or less, hate themselves, they hate life, they hate other species, and there's just total resentment, total hate, and a will of evil and a will of destruction. The title of the show today is, quote, The Henchman of Violence, nihilism and capitalism. Nazarita, welcome to the show. Our listeners are always happy to hear from you. What I want to focus on one question, if we can, for a moment. Thinking about evolution, thinking about if we accept it, right, as a theory that explains how we came to be and where we are, being such a young species, having not been on this planet that long compared to other life forms, and inversely, having created more destruction of the world, the planet, biosphere than any other species ever has. What does this mean? What does this mean in the theory of evolution? What does this mean for the future? I know you have some thoughts on this. We've talked about it recently.
That's, part of, it's really responding to what you were saying about violence, and this adolescent, you know, free killing and how it is destructive and irresponsible, childlike and regressive and addictive. And I've been seeing this recently because I've been thinking about how we live our lives. And I just read recently that, you know, the way that we construct our houses is changing the way that we think. And I think you could trace it back. It's maybe the way we're thinking is actually changing our houses also. They're influencing the way that we live. And when we create structures that are like a monoculture, everything is the same, maybe tiered down according to expense, but they're all the same, you know. And the world is becoming more like the culture in the United States. Everybody has a TV, everybody has a couch, everybody has this. Everybody wants the same things, which starts to sound like a monoculture. You really look at it, and how do you escape monoculture? You do things that are regressive, irresponsible, destructive, childlike, aggressive, addictive, and that's violence. And so I'm thinking, as a species, if we are entering a period where we're adolescent humans, adolescents, and we don't have the responsibility of seeing the beauty of the earth, but we're destructive and we're trying to escape this monoculture, which I know a lot of people, Midwest, West, they hunt. And these people kill other species for pleasure. They take great and pleasure in this. They derive joy in the killing and how much they can kill. And they couch it in terms of, you know, well, they're eating what they catch, but if you really look at it, there's great pleasure and creativity in the way that they kill. And most of these people have pictures of wildlife on their walls in their houses. I would say 99% of them have beautiful pictures of wildlife in their houses. And yet their destruction is with killing and hunting. And I'm thinking this is like the inversion of escaping monoculture. Like I'm going to be destructive. And obviously other forms of violence in this evolutionary scheme of people is that there's always a few people that part of the greater population that begins to see where culture is and to have times of despair. I would say times of despair when you see how people all the same, that they want the same, that they don't want to make an effort to change what they're doing, and they kind of placate each other by saying it's good. What they're doing bad is actually good. And they couch it in these different terminologies that make it sound like they're doing something better, but they're really not. You know, I'm wearing a bracelet that says, you know, save the wildlife, or a button that says, you know, stop fur, while I'm getting this cute little keychain with a little ball of fur on it. It's this hypocrisy that lives with violence. It lives side by side. Pictures of wildlife, beauty, and nature, along with hunting and killing, and putting the stupid head on your wall so you could see what you have done and remember it, and everybody else can see that also. I find this is what I think of as a de-evolution. And where I think this is coming from is part of it is technology, that it's influencing us to become not aware of the other in terms of the real. It's influencing us to become aware of the other in terms of a two-dimensional object on our phones, on our computers, but not real. It's a pseudo connection to the world that if we unplug electricity, that connection is gone. There's no realness in it. And so I believe that usurps our responsibility to the other. We can write something beautiful to the other and think that we have done a good deed. We can do this and still think that we're participating in changing the world. But as you were talking about, the practice is missing. The realness is missing. Where is that? And I think that part of it is technology, where we are, that we've created this fast culture. And one last thought is, you know, this has happened before. Like when Rome invaded the Celts, and the Celts thought the Romans were the lovers of luxury, that they had grown soft, that they had missed the connection with the earth, that they were indulgent, that they loved entertainment, and they had lost their connection to the real, the earth. And they did. That's why they fought so hard against Rome, trying to conquer them. It was like, we have a connection to the earth. You are soft. And that's what our culture has really become. It's become soft, entertainment-loving, addictive, violent, regressive, childlike, irresponsible, destructive. And yet we put words on it that make it seem like we're evolved. I find that an interesting language connection.
Yeah, I was just thinking about how violence seems to feed on itself too, right? Structurally and in the media. I think sometimes, just from my normal experience of life, violence becomes normalized. You know, if you hit somebody, it's easier to hit them again. If you kill somebody, it's easier to kill another person. And it seems to me that we've really normalized that world structure, which I call an ontology. In other words, an arrangement and an order of who we are, of being. And my concern is that we've gotten so far out, I mean, so far afield, with any kind of normal, honest, accurate understanding of our planet, that it's going to be really difficult to find our way back home. And this is not to say that some of our science and some of our awareness is not astute, because it is. I know lots of people who have very, very clear views about what's going on. But this is what nihilism does. If a person doesn't understand what nihilism does, then they're going to miss the nefariousness in which we live. So what nihilism does is it takes all those ordered truths from really good scientists and thinkers and philosophers and analysts and all of us good people. We're working really hard to heal and repair. And it sets it as a subset of thinking. These are subset subsets of objects, really. They're micro worlds within a larger world. And they are distorted, paralyzed, inoperative, unforceful in our culture as other values suppress the truth. And that's the really clever thing about nihilism. You can have the truth right in front of your eyes but not see it. There's a lot of mind manipulation that goes on as a part of a culture. So if you have, so the bigger example is violence. Nasrita, you know, we've worked really hard over many years to learn about all the violence that is structuralized into human life. Violence that's structured into homes, violence that's structured into food, violence that's structured into the things we do. And you can pretty much take most things that we use, and there's a violent past, and in many cases, a violent present, like where we source items, what really goes on to get a certain product or a certain way of life. And we've embedded, so what nihilism does is it recruits these non-self doctrines, and I'm not talking about the non-self doctrine of Taoism or anything good like that. I'm talking about a Western strategy in culture that moves people away from being able to be responsible and to be critical thinkers, which is a disaster. So it's a moral disaster and a life disaster. So nihilism recruits violence. And it's really easy to point out the violence that is not yet recruited, or it's not recruited in a clever way yet. So when people do violent things that the media picks up on, we'll call it subjective violence, it's really easy for people to point out and make hysterical claims about that violence. But what happens is that we only focus on those things. But we don't focus on what's leading to those things or the structural violence that sets it up to occur. And if you really sit back and think about it, it's a clever strategy to hide the deeper level of violence that's occurring in our very structure. And I think in a lot of ways it is causal. It's explanatory and causal. So when we take violence, so all the violence towards farm animals, agribusiness wants to hide that. So we know that violence is going on. Almost everybody actually does. We know. Towards pigs, cows, chickens. But that truth, it sits in there as an ordering principle in our cultural perception, but it doesn't have any force or has very little force. So naturally, agribusiness wants to use the media. They actually put pictures and advertisements of happy pigs, happy chickens, happy cows. They're miserable. They're not happy. And people start believing that you can have a happy pig or a happy cow, and then they're killed. Now, this doesn't mean that there aren't some exceptions. There's always exceptions. Maybe there's a happy pig somewhere in a small farm. But by and large, the industry as it goes, as a whole, is extremely violent to farm animals. But what happens is that truth has a relationship. So there's a relational element in topological logic. It's topology. So, and it's a phenomenology because it's relational. It becomes suppressed or subjugated to a different narrative. And you know, that narrative is filled by cute little packages in the meat department at your grocery store, or like I said, those ads, or you know, Future Farmers of America and their little organizational mission statements. And there's lots of other ways to talk about these things that maintain the true narrative, but they suppress it. And that's hard for people to see. It takes a while to practice your eyes and your thinking to see that. So we do have violence. There is violence in a dog breeding. Various levels of violence in dog breeding. And in dog breeding operations, small and large, again, the violence is hidden. And every now and then you'll see a YouTube video that shows that violence. But at the same time, there'll be other videos that show how happy dogs are and how cool dog breeders are as people. You see, so there are these narratives that get buried. And so a person might say, dog breeding is a good thing, even though some people abuse it. And this is the same strategy that corporations use. They'll say things like, this corporation has a policy against that behavior. This is not the norm for this company. We fired that person. But it goes on and on and on. You see how there's a sleight of hand involved in a lot of institutional violence. Violence towards very poor teenage girls who are more and more being prevented from getting gynecological health care so that they can make good autonomous choices. They're prevented from getting abortions in a lot of states now. That's violent. So in order to understand the violence, you have to really look at concretely the situation of a teenage girl who is pregnant. There's no father to be found. He's gone. Her parents kick her out of the house because they don't want to feed another mouth, or they're ashamed. So now you have a 15 or 16-year-old girl on the street with a baby. And then there are subjective acts of violence towards that baby and that girl in various ways. She's either raped or she becomes a drug addict. Child is often sold into prostitution or some kind of slavery or abused and beaten to death. But people want to suppress that truth in favor of another truth that feels better. So what I'm trying to say, Nazarita, in the best way I know how, is that there's a narrative structure that distorts the truth in culture that's violent, that is operating in terms of a nihilist logic. What do you think about that?
Well, that's really potent. It's really profound that here we are digging into things that are really evident. If everybody could look around and actually see them, they're not really hidden. Agribusiness is not really hidden. Nihilism is not hidden from us. It's not like we have to really dig and find it, or that, you know, it's so far from our natural everyday reality that we can't, it's hard except for a few of us to see it. It's right there in front of us. It's not even well hidden. You know what I mean?
Right. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So it's not, and I didn't mean to put you on the spot, but it's really difficult for many people to see. So think about various self structures or self topologies. It's a topic most people don't want to think about. But I'll whittle it down to just a few so that people can get the understanding. There's a group of people in our culture. They're very complacent, and they are the most conflicted of all. They know what's going on. They really do. They could actually tell you what's going on. But they're complacent. They have a weakness of will, which is the Greek akrasia. They have the weakness of will. They have a propensity for self-deception and inauthentic behavior. They love the status quo. They love conservatism. That's the complacent self-structure. Here's another one, the hysteric. The hysteric always has an emotional reaction to things, but no thought attached. It's great to have an emotional reaction. It means you're healthy. But it's not great if that's all you have. If that's in your bag of tricks in life, if that's all you have, you're not very effective. So hysteric is a person who is so depresenced from their cognitive, responsible mind that all they do is they feel. And it's a catharsis. So a person might say, oh, that's a shame that happened, or that's a travesty, or that's really wrong. They'll have a reaction, that's it. And so there's a fuel or an energy on a graph that goes up and it goes down. So there's two. Here's another one, the sadist. The sadist wants to take all the violence that's going on and wants to take the nihilist structure that we have and in a way poke fun at it, but in a way express their own suffering. Because there's an aggressive, and sadism takes an aggressive stance on violence and nihilism. It says, I want to participate in that too. If this is the way the world is, sign me up. I'm on the field, I'm playing, and I'm going to be sadistic. That means I'm going to enjoy nihilism, which means there are no intrinsic values of any kind. I'm going to enjoy it. And there are people out there, a lot of people in the country, in the United States, that enjoy this role. It's another form of non-self. It's a type of violence. It's self-deceptive. It's not responsible. So there's another one. I'll give you a positive type of self-structure. This is the courageous responsible. The responsible person with courage. They don't adopt any non-self or ecstatic doctrine or totalized doctrine or cathartic doctrine. They are right in the middle of the shit of violence. They feel it, they absorb it, they think about it, and they are doing what they can to transform our culture. And it is like, if you've ever had a project where the more work you did, the more work there was to do. That's what they're in right now. It's not an impossibility. There are the sages who step back, and they've been courageous, they've been responsible. These people are very aware, and they've given up being courageous. They're very aware, they're very intelligent, but they've given up being responsible and courageous. And they will actually make claims that there's going to be a new world. That, if, for example, that artificial intelligence will displace humanity. That may happen, but what about now? See, the question is, what about now? So, What Nazarita and I are going to do starting next week is to construct a segment of shows here where we talk about a way through this. What are some of the ways of thinking? What's a way through? What can we do in the future? What can we do in the future if we know that humanity is going to destroy the planet? What do we do in the future if we're not sure about that? But we know there's going to be great destruction. What are we going to do if we know that most people are going to be complacent and sadistic and hysterical? What do we do? Is there a role for the ethical, responsible, authentic, the courageous self? Is there a role for the courageous self in the world ahead? And what does that look like? And, you know, I'm always reminded by Martin Luther King Jr.'s very wise perception that we're in deep shit, that we're in darkness. It's a long, dark night, and it's cold, and there's terror ahead. There's going to be way more violence. There's going to be total destruction of natural kinds, natural forms, things that make sense to us. The world as it is, we're pulling it apart. With genetic splicing, destruction of whole cultures, colonialism that we've never seen before, and a violence that we've never seen before. So life as you know it is receding. So is there room for the highly creative, imaginative, nonviolent person? Yes, there is that role. Nazarita, we have 3 or 4 minutes left. If you want to take us to close, that would be great.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the way that we talk and the way that we act, and how we embrace these different negative structures of hysterical or, you know, the sadist. And what I always think is to ask yourself some questions and to act different. Like if you held your thought or held your words that were violent and sadistic and blaming, or you held your words that were hysterical, filled with emotion that didn't actually do anything good for yourself or for others, but created a shell around you, if you could change that, if only one time a day, and observe how that changed your life, and it would if you would do it. Like if you knew that by changing that, you would change those around you and change your life, would you do it?
Well, yeah, and the problem now is we don't know. Right, it's really hard for people to know. Here's what I think happens, Nazarita, for a lot of people. They just become overwhelmed, and they shut down. And they don't have to. It's choice. But they do shut down. They become overwhelmed. And we lose power of solidarity. We lose power of the group for healing process. And that's why the moral imperative, I think, now is higher, the benchmark is higher and stronger than it's ever been. For any person who's halfway aware of what's going on, the moral imperative is extremely high, the bench is high. And there's no more time for excuses. We're in a crisis right now. We are in a social, political, economic, environmental, moral crisis on this planet. And we're not going to be able to buy our way out of it. We can use thinking to think our way out of it, but it's even more than that. We have to commit our way out of it. So it's the same thing when we do conflict resolution work for two people. It's about not getting the other guy to do work. It's not to point fingers. It's to look in the mirror and decide what you're going to take on. And what am I going to do today? What are my 24 hours today going to bring? That's my responsibility. So, again, I want to thank everybody for being a loyal listener. It's December 10th today. We will do our show on the 17th. And we will do our show on the 24th. And we will do our show on the 31st. So we only have a few more shows to take us to the end of this calendar year, and then we will continue on. Thank you, Nazarita, for being on the show. I'm really looking forward to next week. It's going to be creative and imaginative. Thank you to everybody for listening. This is Epis Radio, signing out, wishing you all a good day.